The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Alex Abay is a New York Times notable book author and Emmy-nominated TV reporter and screenwriter. His nonfiction work includes Shadow Enemies, a nonfiction account of a plot by Adolf Hitler to start a wave of terror and destruction in the U.S. Alex was born in Cuba and migrated with his family to the United States when he was 10. He grew up in New York and attended Columbia University. He moved to Los Angeles in the late 80s to pursue a writing career, and while in Los Angeles, he worked as assistant to a private investigator and as a Los Angeles Superior Court interpreter. I love the breadth of his career. It's quite wonderful. His experiences inspired him to write a legal thriller, The Killing of the Saints, featuring a Cuban-American hero, Charlie Morell, a lawyer and private investigator. His second novel, The Great American, recounts the true adventures of William Morgan, a U.S. Marine who fought in the mountains of Cuba with Fidel Castro. He also published the sequels to The Killing of the Saints, Dead of Night, and Final Acts. And we did just agree backstage that the best Cuban coffee in L.A. is probably at the Café Tropical in my neighborhood, so I was very pleased to get that confirmation. Abea's most recent book, which he will discuss tonight with NPR foreign correspondent Mike Schuster, is Soldiers of Reason, The Rand Corporation and the American Empire, a study of the world's most influential think tank, located right here in our own backyard. Alex was the first journalist to have full access to Rand's files in Santa Monica, and Rand was the first government-sponsored think tank created to give advice to the Air Force on how to make better weapons and wage better wars. Daniel Ellsberg, of course, the Pentagon Papers is a story that came out of Rand, which eventually led to Watergate. And as a sidebar, tomorrow night, John W. Dean, who played such a crucial role in the Watergate case, will be here on stage interviewing Robert Scheer. Longtime Rand analyst Andrew Marshall is credited with the revolution in military affairs that guided Operation Iraq Freedom and Operation Desert Storm. Yet Rand also recently published an influential study warning of the mental health dangers faced by returning Iraq vets. What has changed at Rand since its founding, and what has stayed the same? Perhaps we'll find out tonight. You've probably heard Mike Schuster's voice on your local NPR affiliate reporting from Tehran or Baghdad or most recently from Singapore on the Myanmar crisis. Mike is based in NPR's LA bureau, and when he's not traveling outside the U.S., he covers issues of nuclear non-proliferation and weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, and the Pacific Rim. In the past 2 years, he has contributed many reports to NPR's extensive coverage of the Middle East, and we're always thrilled to have Mike here as an interviewer. So without further ado, please welcome Alex Abea and Mike Schuster to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Mike, and this is Alex. It's always good to be back here for the Aloud series. I think it's a terrific series. So thank you, Louise. Let's start at the beginning.
Sure.
Why is it called the Rand Corporation, and how did it start?
All right. It began in 1946 as an attempt by the U.S. Army Air Force. At the time, the Army and the Air Force were one body to try to recreate the Manhattan Project that, you know, gave us the atomic bomb. And there was a general named Hap Arnold, Henry Hap Arnold, who thought that we had to continue with that kind of planning, because otherwise businessmen were going to go back to their businesses and scientists were going to go back to the lab, and nobody wanted to be for the armed forces. So he basically cut a check for $10 million and gave it to the scientists that he knew, and he said, you know, go to town, boys, you know, start developing new weapons of war and how to best to wage war against our enemies. Try to concentrate on developing intercontinental ballistic missiles, because we think that missiles are the way for the future, and that way we don't have to have bombers actually taking atomic bombs out there. But otherwise, do as you
wish. But this was at a time when there weren't missiles.
No, there were no missiles. I mean, there were missiles, but they, obviously, you know, we had had them during, during World War II. But there were no intercontinental ballistic missiles. And there was no way, I mean, the A-bomb, the atomic bomb, had to be actually flown by
delivered.
A bomber.
Yeah.
Delivered right. By a bomber. And, you know, he thought that that's the way for the future is, you know, to try to get it all in missiles. And, but he said, although other than that, you know, go ahead. And, you know, he basically, he cut him a blank check. And that's how it began. Now, the name itself was supposed to be provisional. It was supposed to be the temporary name until they came up with something else. Just, or they said, well, we'll call it research and development. That's what it stands for.
Shortened to RAND.
That's right. Of course, the big joke since 1946 is that it stands really for research and no development because they never make anything. They just think.
And and they never came up with another name.
No. And just like the first president of RAND, who was a guy named Franklin Colbom, or Frank Colbom, he was supposed to be also the president for only, you know, a few months, and he stayed there for more than 20 years.
What is rational choice theory? You write about this a lot, and you attribute it to RAND. Explain to us why it's important and why you call it the Matrix Code of the West.
Well, yeah, that's why I feel that. Well, let me put it this way. When I first started doing the research on RAND, and I approached them, I was really surprised that they were going to give me their cooperation, which they did. They were very kind about that. I thought that I was just going to do, like, let's say a general history of the place. You know, it's like, I don't know, General Motors or something like that. And then the more I researched, the more I realized how important this outfit had been to the degree that they had really shape the way that we live, and something that I had never realized before. And that's why I said it's really like the Matrix. It's like we live in their world, we're not even aware of it. And I think that the major point of that thing is a rational choice theory, which was largely developed at the RAND Corporation. Rational choice theory is a theory that presupposes that all of us are rational, that we all act rationally all the time, and that the number one good is self, is towards the self. That is, that looking out for number one is the highest expression of good, and that society should be organized according to those principles.
This is very much an Ayn Rand idea.
Exactly. I know, it's Rand, very interesting. Obviously, it has a lot of similarities with, you know, the Chicago School of Economics and Milton Friedman and all those guys, and there was a lot of crossbreeding between the two organizations. Anyhow, this provided a theoretical foundation for the changes that occurred in the 1970s and 80s, especially under President Reagan. If I could, you know, if I could elaborate on that a little bit, because what happens is that rational choice comes about when the United States and the Soviet Union are in a gigantic clash of civilizations, each one with a different social system. We have democratic capitalism; they have centralized collectivist form of government, and Marxist-Leninist. And obviously, Marxist-Leninism comes up with the dictum of from each according to his according to
from each according to his means,
exactly.
To each according to his needs,
to his needs, right, to his ability, right, and to each according to his needs, right. Which means that then the collective is the one that actually is deciding, you know, what is, because somebody has to decide. Well, what are your needs, and, you know, what are your talents? So there was an economist named Kenneth Arrow who had been assigned the task of trying to figure out formally, that is in mathematical terms, how the Soviet Union would react in case that we went to war. As a result of that, he came up with something called Arrow's theorem that posited, basically in formal terms, that if you have two people who have to decide among three or more things in order of preference, that there's no way that they can come to an agreement unless one of them imposes his will on the other. Which to me makes absolutely no sense. But then, on the other hand, I never believed in the inexorable movement of history either, as, you know, Marx and Engels say. Mm-hmm. So in any case, that was used as a foundation for constructing something called consumer sovereignty, whereby the individual is the one who decides what is best for him. Now, in theory, that's great, because that means that then you have the choices of the individual at the core of your social system. But on the other hand, that also means that a lot of other things that depend on cooperation go out the window because they're really, you know, they don't have a foundation, such as, for instance, religion, altruism, and even patriotism. And government, of course, even then government really becomes the problem and not the solution because you believe then that politicians are self-interested actors who are only in it for themselves or their small vested interest. And therefore, there's no such thing as a you know, collective view. And therefore, that also excuses corporations from any obligation to anybody but their shareholders. And as you know, in America, we had this tradition dating back after the turmoil of the 1920s in which corporations actually cared about the community that they were in because they felt they had a social obligation. Well, this theory comes along and is hijacked by very powerful economic interests. And say, no, we have no obligation to anybody but our shareholders, which means, we can fire you, we can let go of, a whole bunch of people, we can do whatever we want as long as we don't break the law. So all these ties that bind us together are dissolved by rational choice.
Why did Rand attract this school of thought and this school of thinkers in such a concentrated way? I mean, you've already pointed out there are other ways of thinking about society and thinking about government and thinking about the relationship of the individual to society. What was there about Rand so early that so much concentrated this theory?
It's their belief in reason, reason as the ultimate template of all human activity. From the beginning, in one of the one of the speeches that one of the founders gave, and when they had this big gathering of social scientists in New York City, because at the beginning, when Rand was set up in 1946, within a year or so, they decided that they had to really attract social scientists in order to be able to expand their influence and their views. And at a speech that was given by one of these guys, he said, we believe in rationality. We believe in seeking order through reason and the reasoned life. And, of course, that attracts that kind of person who really thinks that rationality is the end-all and be-all of life. That's a problem. Because I think rationality is just a tool for an irrational desire, for our irrational desires. It's not that we're basically irrational; we are not. It's just the way that we approach the world. But yet they view it as though it has to be this particular way. And I think that's part of the reason why following rational choice and the way that that happened, that numerical kind of view of the world, that got us into Vietnam and got us into Iraq.
You mentioned that from the beginning, the Air Force wanted the people at Rand to think about missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles,
right,
nuclear weapons, and their delivery systems. From the beginning, nuclear targeting was very important at Rand.
Yes.
What was that all about? What were they thinking about when they were thinking about nuclear targeting?
How to best wipe out the enemy. It's simple. I mean, how many hundreds of millions are we going to kill? And that's why you get somebody like Herman Kahn, who comes out of Rand, who some of you in the audience may have heard of. And he was a Rand researcher, physicist, who came up with this whole system of civil defense. And he was actually advocating, in so many words, the use of nuclear weapons, or at least he was going around the country telling people, there's nothing to fear if we go to, we have an atomic war, a nuclear war with the Soviet Union, because sure, 20 or 30 million of us will die, but then we will no longer have an enemy, and we'll be able to take over the world. And even if you have this all this radiation going around, well, there's a lot of mutations going on anyhow, so it really doesn't matter. And, we'll portion the food, we'll ration the food accordingly, and, we'll dig these tunnels under the earth, and, we'll have these caves, and when we come out, the world will be ours. So it's that kind of thinking, that's what they were working on.
Herman Kahn is said to be a model for Dr. Strangelove.
Yes, Herman Kahn was one of them. Matter of fact, Stanley Kubrick borrowed so many of Kahn's thoughts and mannerisms that he wanted to collect royalties from Kubrick. And Kubrick told, no way, Herman, that's not the way it's done.
And these guys who thought this way believed that this was rational theory, right? They believed that this was rational. I mean, Herman Kahn.
Yes, of course.
Herman Kahn did studies about the fighting of nuclear war,
yes,
in which tens of millions of people are killed on both sides.
Right.
And they believed that this was rational. And I gather that they were really intellectual powerhouses that were very difficult to argue with, to dislodge from the,
Oh, absolutely, because it's like even to this date. I mean, it's the most brilliant collection of minds, I guess. What's the phrase? Since Thomas Jefferson sat down to dinner, was that what Kennedy said? Whatever it is. They're brilliant. There's no doubt about that. But on the other hand, there's one thing that's missing from their compass, which is morality. Is this the right thing to do? They, of course, you know, if you believe in rational choice, then that's, you can't have morality because morality, after all, derives from, you might say, a Kantian absolute perspective on the world. You know, is this the right thing to do? How should we act? But if you act rationally, according to rational choice, in which, you know, your self-interest is the number one goal of your existence, then there is no morality because whatever makes you, whatever gets you what you want is what's moral. Well, that is, there is no moral because the only thing that counts is getting what I want.
The other great intellectual powerhouse of Rand in those years was Albert Wolstetter. Not as familiar a name as Herman.
No, and he kept it that way. He wanted to be behind the scenes.
Tell us about him.
Albert Wolstetter was a brilliant man. It's my sole regret in doing this whole thing is that I never got to meet him. He was like a lot of these people in Rand. He was a secular Jew. His parents were Jewish, but, you know, he really didn't practice a religion, even though once he was asked, you know, are you Jewish? And he said, oh, heavens, no, but my parents are. You know, so it was Ellsberg, so it was Kahn, a lot of these guys, which is not to say, I don't want to go into that whole anti-Semitism thing, but it's just curious because it's like when somebody who renounces their religion or this certain way of being, in any case, that also dates back to New York intellectuals. And he was part of that whole group of New Yorkers. He was born in New York. He was a brilliant mathematician. He was hired by Rand, I believe it was in 1949, after his wife. His wife was Roberta Wolstetter, who wrote the seminal study on the Pearl Harbor attack.
This was some years later she wrote this.
Well, yes, exactly. She was... Andrew Marshall, who is now at the Office of Net Affairs, still there since James Schlesinger in the 1970s, which is really amazing because the man must be pushing 90 by now.
Yeah.
And he's still there. And he was the one who suggested it to Roberta Wolstetter. And she won a Bancroft Prize for History. In any case, so Albert Wolstetter was hired by Rand, and he was a mathematician. And he was really sort of a snob. But he was, you know, obviously an appealing kind of guy, but, you know, he was a gourmand. He loved classical music. He had taken classes with a modern dance troupe. He knew all Le Corbusier and all these different... He was a lover of modernism, so to speak. So he was hired by Rand to do some research, and they offered him this particular job, which is, you know, how would you defend our nuclear forces from attack by the Soviet Union? And he came up with this.
This was the basing study.
This
right?
was the basing study, exactly, which made his name and his fortune, and actually Rand's fortune as well, because they were able to thwart what conceivably could have been a sneak Soviet attack on our nuclear forces in Europe and possibly in the United States as well. And then after that, he just became the top nuclear strategist of the era. He wrote a very influential foreign affairs article called The Delicate Balance of Terror, in which he argued that the policy of mutual assured destruction, or even though he didn't call it that, but it was what Eisenhower was following at the time, that, you know, was no good, and that what you actually had to have was second strike capability to be able to respond to the Soviets after that.
So you see him as responsible for some of the basic concepts of nuclear doctrine that the United States functioned under during the Cold War.
Yes, absolutely. And it goes beyond that. I mean, he was also part of the group that helped get JFK into office, because at the time, Eisenhower was trying to come to a deal with Khrushchev and the Soviet Union, the Premier Nikita Khrushchev, trying to have disarmament talks. But there were a group of people who Eisenhower would later term the military-industrial complex that were very much opposed to that. And one of their... weapons was a report that came from a group called the Gaither the Gaither group on national defense, and they argued that there was a missile gap in the United States, and the Soviets were having all these different missiles, and you know we were lagging woefully behind.
This became a key issue in the 1960 presidential.
Absolutely, campaign. Kennedy went around saying, you know, we have to get this country moving again. We have to rearm, etc. Of course, afterwards, once he got into office, you know, McNamara, who became Secretary of Defense, within a couple of months, said, well, you know, there is no real missile gap. Actually, if there is a missile gap, it's in our favor. So that's the kind of thing that Wallstetter was involved in.
How was Wallstetter involved in that? As I understand it, the information about the alleged tenfold more missiles on the Soviet side than on the American side came from misanalysis by the CIA.
That is correct, but that information was top secret. It was highly classified, and it was leaked to the Kennedy campaign by a group of RAND researchers led by Wallstetter. That's how the information got out. And then afterwards, Vietnam came around. And, you know, he argued, well, we shouldn't get involved in Vietnam because Vietnam is just going to divert us from our main enemy, which is the Soviet Union. Then when Nixon and Ford started détente, he was one of the main instigators of the movement to strangle détente, to saying, you know, it's immoral to deal with the Soviet Union. And we can't trust them. And they're building up their defenses and, you know, they're going to obliterate us. You know, and basically they managed to stop a lot of the movement for détente that existed. And when Reagan came in, you know, he got a medal from the president.
Wallstetter did. Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Wallstetter did.
Wallstetter did, yeah.
By that time, Wallstetter had left the RAND Corporation.
Yes, right. And that's a funny story in and of itself. Because Wallstetter was a very gregarious kind of guy. And, you know, he gave information left and right. And there was another luminary within RAND, a guy named Bernard Brody, who was actually the father of nuclear strategy, who disliked Wallstetter, and they disliked each other because they had two different ways of approaching the world. Brody was a historian, and he took the qualitative perspective to analysis, while Wallstetter took the quantitative perspective to analysis, being a mathematician. So, you know, he would assume, he would depart from certain points and then just develop it mathematically, while Bernard Brody would try to develop a history of the whole thing and try to use psychology to decipher how people would react under certain circumstances. And Wallstetter was the darling of RAND. And what happened is that Bernard Brody was able to get Wallstetter fired in 1962, I believe it was, because he had left his report, this classified report, out, and it had leaked to someone. And since Wallstetter didn't get along with Frank Colbum, because they had done an end run around the Air Force when McNamara was installed as Secretary of Defense, he got fired. And after that, you know, he went to UCLA, Wallstetter, and then he went to the University of Chicago.
Wallstetter was a contemporary, more or less, of Robert Oppenheimer and some others. And you discovered something very interesting about Wallstetter, where people like Oppenheimer and others who had a leftist background in the 30s ultimately suffered from that in the 1950s. Wallstetter had a similar background and managed to keep it secret.
That's right. That's right. He belonged to an offshoot Trotskyite organization. Can I tell you? A lot of these guys...
in New York City, from City College of New York, there were plenty of people in the 30s part of those groups.
Matter of fact, his own daughter, Joan, said, well, you know, I don't know if he belonged to this particular organization or not, but I know, you know, he did belong, you know, he was of the left. A lot of people were at the time. And even Morton White, the philosopher who was introduced to this particular organization, offshoot, by Wallstetter, said, you know, yeah, he belonged, but so did a lot of other people. It wasn't that uncommon. What was uncommon is how he managed to keep it a secret.
Was to avoid the witch hunt that came
exactly
20 years later.
Now, according to what Dan Ellsberg tells me, he heard this from somebody who had direct knowledge of this. What happened is that all the records of that particular group were lost.
That's right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. When apparently the records this was the 1930s, and you still had horse-drawn carriages in New York City. So what happened is that the horse died in an intersection, and all the records fell off. And the guy got so scared, thinking the FBI is going to come after me, he just left. So therefore, New York Sanitation came and took all the records. So they had no more records. So they had nothing in writing. You know, it's a nice story. I'm sure it's true to some degree.
Do you believe it?
Who
told you that story?
Dan Ellsberg.
Uh-huh.
Daniel Ellsberg, who also came from RAND. Daniel Ellsberg is the guy who released the Pentagon Papers. I believe that's true to some degree, but I do also believe that that's the reason why Albert Wallstetter never held any official titles in government. I don't know if you're aware of that. After he left RAND in 63, he was an informal advisor, but he never held any official title. Like, for instance, he was never hired by McNamara, like Alan Enhoven was, or like Hitch was, Alfred Hitch, a lot of these guys, because when McNamara came in 1960, he hired wholesale from the RAND Corporation, because McNamara was a RANDite and believed in rational choice theory even before he knew what RAND was or how they thought, because he believed in the quantitative method of life.
He had come from the Ford Motor Company.
Exactly. You know, he had set up what you called they called his whiz kids, the guys who went in and reshaped the Ford Motor Company, and he became president of the Ford Motor Company. I think he was 40 years old at the time, and Kennedy hired him. And it's funny because when they hired him, he had an interview with Kennedy. Kennedy asked him, I want you to be Secretary of Defense. And he says, well, I don't know if I'm qualified to be Secretary of Defense, Mr. President. And Kennedy said, sarcastically, well, who is? Of course, nobody was. Because the point is, he had to learn on the job. But he already was like that. So in order to recruit his own people, because that's one of the things that he got Kennedy to agree to, that is, if he was going to be Secretary of Defense, he could hire his own crew. So he started hiring from the RAND Corporation, and then they became McNamara's whiz kids, and they totally reshaped the Pentagon.
Among the concepts that Wallstetter is credited with, according to your book, is the concept of fail-safe. This is a notion that is connected to a book and a movie with
right.
Henry Fonda, a terrific movie from
great
the early
movie.
60s that some people will remember. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, Wallstetter, when he was a kid, was a big fan of railroads, of trains. And in railroads and in trains, according to what I've read and what I've been told, I don't know because I was never that big. I was never into trains myself. But according to that, there is a particular procedure whereby, you can only go so far, and then, if you don't get a green light, you're forced to then go stop. And then he applied that to bombers. This is before missiles. And he said, so... Excuse me. So if our people go out on a bombing mission and they don't get a green light at different stages, then the pilot, has to come back, to make sure that we're not accidentally bombing Moscow when perhaps it was just, the wrong message. And as far as I know, according to my research, as late as just a few years ago, that was still happening. We still have bombers and, red alerts, send out the bombers, et cetera. And, they were called back because of that system.
So RAND goes through the 50s and into the 60s, through the Kennedy administration, into the Johnson administration, developing the essential foundation for nuclear doctrine in America. Were there any dissenting voices in RAND about that?
Not about that.
Not about that.
No. I think the main dissension in RAND starts with the Vietnam War.
But the RAND begins the Vietnam War doing studies for the military on how best to carry out the war.
Oh, even before that. Mm-hmm. They started with counterinsurgency studies in the late 1950s. Even before we actually get involved militarily, we were already talking about, the lessons of the French in Algeria, the lessons of the British in Malaysia, and how best to defeat a counterinsurgency movement, and advocating the use of the military as a force for progress in underdeveloped countries. Which to me sounds absurd, but that's what they thought at the time. So they started getting involved in that way before that.
How did they become involved in that? Were these also contracts from
the Pentagon commissioned them to do that, right? But it's Vietnam, I think, that really changes RAND, because they, from their own studies, they were commissioned by McNamara to do a study on the morale of the Viet Cong. Because they couldn't figure out why these guys were fighting so hard. After all, it's not rational.
right?
It's obvious that the U.S. is stronger, has many more weapons, and we can obliterate your village, etc. How many more are your people gonna have killed until you finally give up? Which, again, another as a corollary of rational choice is something called counterforce, which is the application of force in stages until finally your enemy cries uncle, so to speak. But Uncle Ho Chi Minh wasn't about to cry uncle. They were in it to the finish, to the death. So they started this study on the morale of the Viet Cong, and they went around South Vietnam questioning all these different captured VC. And they were really amazed, and they realized that these guys were real patriots, that they were communist dupes, but that, they wanted better education for their kids, they wanted to be free of foreign interference, and they wanted their country to be reunited. They were real patriots. And not only that, they all said that they were all ready to die for their cause. So at one point, when that was reported to the people at the Defense Department, one of them turned to the other and said, I think we signed up with the wrong side in this war. And yes, so it was. But at that point, when the results were finally in 1965, by that point we had Johnson. And Johnson was determined not to be the first American president ever to lose a war since the War of 1812.
These were some RAND analysts that were probing these issues and beginning to understand even early on the notions of Vietnamese nationalism, it seems to me. But the higher-ups and the big intellectual guns at RAND, did they understand this or did they reject these ideas?
The top hierarchy rejected that idea, and they were all for the Air Force. As you know, the Air Force was extremely instrumental in Vietnam, that we had carpet bombing.
Right.
And they were all for carpet bombings. They thought that, if we keep carpet bombing them, then, let me see, how did it go? If we keep carpet bombing them, then they're going to turn against the VC because they will realize that if only they gave their allegiance to us, we wouldn't have to bomb them. So therefore, they should be on our side. So therefore, they should hate
population,
the VC.
The population
That's
of
right,
South
the
Vietnam.
Vietnamese.
Yeah,
right. The Vietnamese should turn against the VC because, right, so this is part of their studies. Which makes absolutely no sense. I mean, even that is not rational, but that's what they did. So the top hierarchy was like that. But then you have people like Ellsberg, who at first was a hawk, all in favor of our intervention in Southeast Asia. But after a couple of visits there, he realized that, this was not a war that could be won. And basically, we were morally wrong to be there, that we should be out of there. And then we had a lot of dissension within RAND. I mean, you have some people writing letters to the New York Times saying we should get out of Vietnam, and then the countervailing bunch on the other side, saying, no, we should stay, the government is right, etc. So there was, RAND was rift with dissension. And that's how come, Ellsberg did what he did.
And what did he do?
What he did is that he took out the only other copy of the Pentagon Papers that existed. There was one copy in the office of the Secretary of Defense and one copy in Ellsberg's safe.
Now, just so we understand, the Pentagon Papers were a secret history of the war in Vietnam written by the Pentagon or written by RAND?
No, it was a collection of documents. It wasn't even a formal history. That is, there was no narrative thread by a particular author. You had to infer the narrative from reading all the different documents dating back to the 1940s of our involvement in Vietnam.
And RAND had this collection of documents because which had originated at the Pentagon.
Exactly, because they had been commissioned to do so by McNamara, who wanted to know himself, how do we get involved in this mess? How do we get here? And Ellsberg had a copy of that. And the other copy was in the office of the Secretary of Defense. So he had tried to get McNamara to change. He had tried to get the government to pull out of Vietnam. He couldn't get it. He couldn't get them to react. So therefore, he said, okay, I'll go to the public. I'll go to the American public, and American voters will be so upset when they hear this that they will demand that the war end. Kind of idealistic, but, that's what he did.
And so Ellsberg took this collection of documents out of RAND.
Right, little by little, because it was volumes. I think it was about 30 volumes of papers, and each volume is about yay big. So it was a whole bunch of them.
And this was classified material.
And this was top secret.
So absolutely. It was illegal to do this.
Do you know, I don't think they ever really quite decided whether it was actually illegal or not. That's what he was charged with. That's what the government charged them with after they found out that he was the one who had taken them out. But, of course, at that point then, during the trial, when it came out that the plumbers, Richard Nixon's famous plumbers, had gone into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office to see what he had told them and what kind of information they had, and that came out that the government had broken the law in order to pursue this, the case was dropped. So it was never really decided. He was charged, but he was never really found guilty of it.
Before all this became public and before these papers ended up in the possession of the New York Times, which entered into its own controversy by signaling that it wanted to publish them, which got Richard Nixon involved in this. But before that occurred, was it known that Ellsberg had done that within RAND, and did that spark controversy within RAND?
Well, they suspected it because obviously it had to have come from RAND. It was the only place that it could have come from, and you know,
did he have supporters at RAND, or
he had some, but mostly he had critics at that point because you know he wasn't part of the group anymore. He had broken the RAND code of silence, you might speak. You know, the blue code. This was the RAND code. You don't go outside the organization. Even today, when I was doing research for this book, some of the old-timers that I talk about Ellsberg, you know, they were spewing venom when they talked about him. And, you know, they said, you know, the guy should have been sent to jail for what he did.
Even now, after the Vietnam War ended and we have more perspective on what happened in
Even
Vietnam.
Now, that's right, because, you know, he shouldn't have done it. And Wallstetter and Nathan Leidis, who was a noted Sovietologist at the time, they were having lunch in England, in Oxford, and Leidis said, oh, everybody said at the same time at the table, oh, that was Dan. Because after all, they said, well, Dan hasn't published a book yet. And, you know, and therefore he wants to have his name in the papers. And also because, you know, Dan is so gregarious that, you know, he wants to tell the whole story.
Did this breach in security then hurt the RAND Corporation?
Absolutely. I mean, they were really concerned that they were just going to lose their being able to handle top secret documents, they sent a special delegation to see Nixon himself with George Shultz, who would later become Secretary of State, to talk to Nixon, so Nixon would know that, you know, we're keeping tabs on the whole thing.
And is it fair to say that by this time RAND had grown into the premier security think tank in the United States?
Yes, by the 1960s, yes, it had. Of course, by that time, there were also other think tanks that had also sprung up, and other people, you know, it was just, you know, borrowing a page from the RAND method. And that's why RAND at that point decides to try to get into the social sciences.
Now, I want to go back to Albert Wallstetter, because there's another line of inquiry that's very interesting, and that's that Wallstetter's connection to the neoconservatives today.
Right.
When Wallstetter was at RAND and then later at the University of Chicago, he began to gather a group of young people around him who were drawn to his ideas that ultimately became very important in things that happened later.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even dated back to the 1950s, Wallstetter always had his acolytes. He always had his whole bunch of his boys around him, you know, that he was like the teacher. He was the mentor. He was teaching all these guys, you know, the good things of life, you know, about gourmet cooking, about wine, about music, about art and stuff like that. And then it became actually doctrine that he was teaching them, you know, about the perils of the problems of, you know, of our relationship with the Soviet Union. Especially that became even more prominent after he left RAND, and then he went to Chicago, where he really was a teacher. You know, he was a professor. And one of the people that he was a mentor to was Paul Wolfowitz, who, as you know, was the number two guy at the Defense Department, who was the idea man behind the invasion of Iraq in the year 2003.
Wolfowitz was a graduate student at
the University of Chicago
when he came into contact with Wallstetter.
And not only that, Wallstetter had gone to school with Wolfowitz's dad, so they knew each other from Columbia. My alma mater, by the way. So, you know, they all knew each other from that period, so he knew him. And then Wallstetter was also a mentor to Richard Perle, who was also extremely influential in defense matters.
Tell how Wohlstetter first met Richard Perle.
Well, according to the story, and this I've heard from several sources and from Perle himself, Wohlstetter had this great house. I've been to it. It's a really wonderful house up in the Hollywood Hills. And he had a pool. And his daughter was going to Hollywood High School. Because at the time, people did not send their kids to private schools like we do today. If you live in Hollywood, everybody, you know, goes to a private school. Back then, they sent all their kids to the public school, Hollywood High School. And one of his one of her classmates was Richard Perle. So Richard Perle, who was taking Spanish with her, came to the pool party. And he had already heard about Wohlstetter and about his article in Foreign Affairs, you know, Delicate Balance of Terror.
And this was Richard Perle at 15 or 16 years old?
Yeah, he must have been about 16 at the time, exactly. So he struck up a conversation with Wohlstetter. And later Wohlstetter would say that he got, you know, his questions were better than the questions that were asked of him by the people in the Pentagon. That he was a smarter guy than all the other guys that he was dealing with at the Pentagon. So thus began his long relationship with Richard Perle.
So, but Perle and Wolfowitz, there's a connection to thinking and thinkers at Rand, but they were never, were they part of
Rand? Wolfowitz was an intern at Rand. Perle himself never was directly involved with Rand, but obviously through Wohlstetter and through all the people who worked there. But, you know, Condoleezza Rice was also at Rand as well. And, of course, Rumsfeld went from being chairman of the board of the Rand Corporation to being Secretary of Defense.
And Rumsfeld was chairman of the board for quite some time. Is that right?
On two occasions, yes, that's right, for several years. And, you know, he was involved with Rand ever since he became the younger Secretary of Defense back under Ford.
What's interesting is that these ideas that the security thinkers at Rand developed influenced the Kennedy administration first, the Democratic side, but then really took hold in the Reagan administration as well and in the Republican side of politics since then.
Exactly, and I think they've been prevalent ever since. Because you had liberal Republicans like Nixon and Ford that wanted to reach a compromise with the Soviet Union and, you know, who wanted to sort of like curb the excesses of the military-industrial complex. And these guys were totally opposed to it and said, no, we have to even build more weapons in order to control this, in order to make sure that we win. And it's a struggle to the death. And, you know, now what we have is instead of the Soviet Union, we're involved in the same thing. Instead of the Soviet Union, you know, we have the war on terror. And, you know, it's instead of Kennedy, we have, you know, Black Kennedy, you know, Barack Obama. So in a way, we're almost like going back to what we had back then.
You write about the Team B concept. Was Team B a notion that was developed at Rand or through Wohlstetter to these other young men that were going into government?
It wasn't developed at Rand, but a lot of Randites were involved in it. By that point, and here's the thing, Rand became influential not so much because of its institutional efforts, but because of all the efforts that all the people who worked there made, that is, because of the people who went through there.
Explain what Team B is.
Team B was was a team of foreign policy experts who supposedly were going to go through the results that the CIA had on Soviet armaments, and they were going to see what the real intentions of the Soviet Union were, whether it was, you know, the CIA was really arriving at the correct results or assumptions regarding the Soviet Union.
It seems to me this is the continuation of the struggle over the missile gap in 1960, that during this time there were two camps in security studies. One that there were those that tried to really figure out really what was true, and then there were others who believed that our intelligence community was greatly underestimating the strength of the enemy.
Right, and it's all a matter of perspective. And that's the whole point, because they were using CIA figures. But the CIA had one conclusion, and they had another. So it just depends, you know, how do you view the world? How do you view the glass? Is it half empty or half full? These guys kept saying, no, it's half empty. You know, we have to fill it up. And, you know, by the way, the lessons of Team B were very well learned, because some of the people, such as Richard Pipes, who were involved in Team B, later turn up with the outfit that Bush set up in the prelude to the Iraq War.
And the first use of Team B came, do I remember this correctly, when George Bush Sr. was head of the CIA, or did he resist that?
He resisted that. Mm-hmm. They had tried to do it before under Helms, and Helms finally had agreed to do it, but then he had to resign. And then when Bush came in and he was appointed head of the CIA, he said, "Okay, well, go ahead with it. And, you know, let's go with this experiment of Team B." But at the end, you know, he paid no attention to it. And in any case, by the time that the conclusions of Team B came in, President Carter was in office.
And his head of the CIA, Stansfield Turner, didn't like that.
No, they just rejected all the arguments of Team B. However, the people who were in Team B then wound up in the Reagan administration.
Yeah, and many who continued to believe in that kind of idea ended up in the George W. Bush
administration. That is correct, yeah. So matter of fact, what you have is a continuation of those guys, you know, started in the 1970s and they're still with us.
Rand is also considered to have pioneered terrorism studies, is that right?
Yes, because before they set it up, it actually had been just, you know, the province of conspiracy theorists, or people, you know, always, you know, never really think that there's a spook behind every door, and nobody had really paid attention to it because, you know, after all, that's what happened, you know, in foreign countries, and who cared about that? But starting in the early 70s, they start compiling lists of terrorist incidents, and they develop it into a discipline. You know, why they occur, who the terrorists are. They sponsored a number of seminars and published a number of publications on it, and they really set it up. So they really were quite instrumental in making it an academic discipline.
Now let's talk a little bit about Rand now.
Yeah.
First off, is Rand as influential now as it was back then?
Well, I guess we won't know until a lot of those papers are declassified, won't we? Rand still gets 50% of its budget from the federal government, and a lot of that work is classified. In my book, I did not go into classified work. I went into declassified because I wanted to show the influence, the pervasive influence of the Rand Corporation since 1946. But right now, I mean, to give you an instance, just the other day, Barack Obama was quoting the Rand study on the effects of post-traumatic stress on the syndrome on returning veterans from Iraq. So, you know, they're poised to be there, and, you know, whoever it is, whatever the new administration is, because they're part of the continuing Washington establishment. And, you know, they'll always be there. Are they going to be as influential? Well, that depends. It depends on what they come up with.
Well, there's certainly more competition in the think tank world.
Yes, there is. And that's precisely part of the problem, because they generated their own competition. So what they've been trying to do over the last few years is to expand abroad. They have an office in Qatar, and they're trying to reform. They're reforming the educational system over there. They're expanding in other areas. They have links to Afghanistan, especially Saudi Arabia. The Middle East. You know, they have some great ideas. They have a project called the ARC that would try to solve, you know, the perennial Middle East problem by apportioning, you know, land and water resources between Palestinians and Israelis. But, you know, the project was shut down because, you know, it's extremists.
Because there's no peace, no peace yet between Israelis and Palestinians.
Exactly, because they're not acting rationally.
Is there a Rand connection in any way to the war in Iraq?
Well, let's define connection. Institutionally, you might say no, but the persons who actually instigated the war, who were in favor of deposing Saddam Hussein, a lot of them have a very strong Rand connection. So then it begs the question, well, so you don't need actually, do you need the institution to say we're in favor of invading this country when you actually have the people in your institution who are going around writing articles and setting up something like, for instance, the Project for the New American Century? You know, Wolfowitz belonged to it, and Pearl was in it, and Harry Rowan, who was the second president of Rand, was in it, and obviously, you know, people like Cheney and Rumsfeld. And
Clinton also.
So you have all these people who were involved in all this. So therefore, you know, you have to ask yourself, is it really necessary? And, you know, they were advocating deposing Saddam Hussein back, you know, in the late 1990s. So, but, you know, they were there. They have a presence. They tried to reform the legal system without much success. And it's funny, RAND as an institution was hedging its bets in Iraq. And you have the former ambassador to Afghanistan, James Dobbins, who wrote a book on occupation in Japan and in Germany after the Second World War. And he warned that unless there were enough boots on the ground, enough soldiers to control the situation after a successful invasion, that any invasion was doomed to failure. And about 2-3 years ago, he wrote a study saying that, you know, we should just pack up and go, that this is a fight that should be done by the Iraqis and that we have really no interest and we shouldn't be there.
Is it fair to say then that the RAND of today is perhaps more broad-minded and open-minded about options for the United States in security policy and foreign affairs than it may have been before now?
Well, I think that it's because it's learned that it has to, like I said before, has to hedge its bets. It has to make sure that it's there no matter the political coloring of the administration. So you would have, you know, some things that advocate a particular line and others that advocate something else. Like to give you an instance, you know, they were involved in advocating the expansion of NATO to Eastern Europe. And there were a number of studies that were done on that. But yet on the other hand, you know, they have been also saying, watch out for the Soviet Union. So, you know, it goes back and forth.
All right, well, let's open it up to the audience now. I'm sure plenty of people have questions. First, I need to locate the microphone. You've got the microphone. Let's bring it down here in the front first.
I am puzzled, as a mathematician, about the foundation of everything that you've been saying. Because when RAND was set up, they were mathematicians. They were physicists. They were also economists. Those are rational, amoral sciences. I don't want morality in mathematics. I don't want morality in physics. And so everything you're saying rational decision-making. To me, it sounds just like 1776. The wealth of nations and the invisible hand.
Well, that's if you believe in the invisible hand. With all due respect, sir, it's fine to have amoral mathematics, but when you expand that amorality to social systems, I think you have a problem, because we live according to morality, and we have to do what's right.
More questions? Okay, here.
Can you make a judgment as to what major things RAND got wrong and what major things RAND got right?
You're asking for my personal opinion?
Yeah.
Well, I think that they overemphasized rational choice. I think rational choice had to be modified, that you have to recognize that there are forces that go beyond rationality, that, like I said before, that we're not rational beings. And that while rationality, utter rationality or pure rationality might be good in certain scientific realms, that when it comes to society, that you have to be extremely careful to make sure that you always are guided by a sense of morality, of what is right and what is wrong. Are you doing the right thing? And if you're advocating a particular course of action, you're just as responsible as the people who actually carry out that course of action. And I think that's always been the problem with RAND. I mean, they boast of being not only, like I said, not only of coming up with policy choices, but making sure that those policy choices are put in the hands of people who actually hold the levers of power. So I think that's something that they should always watch out for. And, you know, it's you have to have a sense of what is right and what is wrong. And for my part, I wish they would have had the guts, A, to say, I'm sorry, Vietnam is wrong. As an institution to say, Vietnam, the Vietnam War was wrong. The Ford Foundation did that.
And Rand's role in it.
That's right, and acknowledge its role in it. And B, to actually say in one of his studies, and we do not advocate an invasion of Iraq. But they would never say that. Because they have to write the study that the particular patron wants to hear, and that, you know, they have certain parameters that they have to work within. And I guess that they have to start doing that, then, you know, that might kill the organization. I don't know, but it's my own personal perspective.
Did they get anything right?
Did they get anything right? Well, you know, we haven't even talked about the scientific advances that came out of RAND. For instance, you know, they were the forerunners of the internet with packet switching that came out of there. They were involved in satellites. They came up with this project for the first Earth orbiting satellite station back in 1946, when that was something that, you know, came out of, you know, pulp novels and science fiction comics. They were also involved in the other uses of titanium. They have been involved also in curbing floods in the Netherlands and, you know, reforming educational systems and stuff like that. They have done a lot of good, but, you know, they have yet to acknowledge the harm that they've done as well.
Yeah, right there. Yeah.
Did you, going back to the morality question, did you find any examples of mavericks within the organization who perhaps pushed for a less rational and more moral approach but were possibly squashed?
Well, in my experience right now, the RAND that I've met, the RAND that I've talked to, the people that I've talked to, they all stay on message. You know, it's like whatever is, you know, you no longer have people like Herman Kahn or Albert Wallstetter, people, you know, who are like the irritants, you know, to the oyster, you know, so you can get like nice little pearls, you know. No, you don't get that. At least that's the impression that I've had. If they have those discussions, they're really kept in-house, and I didn't hear them.
Any questions? Okay, this gentleman right over here.
Is it your impression that the data drives the conclusions at RAND, or that they come in with an ideology and they're looking for an answer, and then they try and find the data to support the answer?
You know, that's a great question. They boast of, you know, of asking the right question. That is, you know, that the data will supply the answer. But of course, you know, what data are you going to pick? What data are you choosing to deem important and which unimportant? Are you going to put it in a footnote? Are you going to include it at all? And what is your perspective on the thing? So I think dating back to the first major study by the guy who invented systems analysis, you know, it's always the choice of parameters that really determines whether their study is efficacious or not. And in that time with Ed Paxson, who's the guy who created systems analysis, he tried to come up with a theory of war, and he forgot that, you know, he was using people, pilots, as, you know, just replaceable pawns, so he wasn't really paying attention to how many pilots are going to get shot down, or the number of losses, how many planes would be lost, etc.
If I remember correctly, that you write that the Air Force was appalled at this.
Yes, even the Air Force itself was saying, you know, we can't do that to our guys. But, you know, because if you have no morality, if you see people as just pawns to be moved in a mathematical game, then obviously it doesn't really matter. And, you know, and so that's what I'm saying. It's the parameters. It's the choice of the parameters of the question of how are you going to define what surrounds the question that drives the result. That's why they really excel at small, localized things that do not have a direct bearing on life and death, at least in political terms, such as, you know, for instance, you know, the floods in the Netherlands, reforming an educational system. Even though the educational system, you might say, well, do we really have the right to say that people should act this way, or maybe Allah is correct, or maybe, you know, we should just follow the Quran, so therefore you go into ethical questions as well. But they have excelled at things that are of small, restricted applications.
More questions over here? Yes, down here in the front.
Uh, I want to thank you so much. This is a terrific book, and I hope to get it and read it.
Thank you.
But I want to caution here. On NPR, all I hear is the Heritage Foundation, the Council of Foreign Affairs, and then, of course, RAND Corporation, which is part of that. And I want your opinion on these three think tanks who have crafted, promoted destruction around the world historically and continue to do so unless something is done. So I tie them into to just about everything that is going on right now. And like you said, they choose the winning team. They care not who's in power because it's all about the unseen hand. Thank you.
Right. Well, this dates back to this, the permanent establishment in Washington. I mean, the American Enterprise Institute that you refer to, I mean, they have a hall called the Albert Wallstetter Hall. And Richard Perle is one of the scholars in residence over there. Actually, they helped me with my research. I mean, they're very nice people. It's just that, you have to wonder, it's the proliferation of think tanks, the Heritage Foundation as well. They're all of a right-wing bent, and they're especially under the current administration, they have the ear of the administration. And it's part of the permanent establishment of which RAND, I think, is one of the key players.
How about back there?
I hear in the news that Bush is in Europe now and he's beating the drums about Iran. And I wish I knew more about the silent hand, a lot of these other political things. But just reflecting on the ripple effect of the RAND Corporation after all these decades, what's your position or feeling about what a lot of progressive or left-wing radio stations talk about with regard to neocons and the Pearls and the Wolfowitzes and the Cheneys and the Rumsfelds, and how powerful are they? What's in store for us in the next decade, let's say?
Well, fortunately, and this is my own personal opinion, fortunately, Bush is a lame duck, so he'll be out soon. As regards RAND itself, everybody wants to know about Iraq and about Chalabi. Did I mention that Chalabi was introduced to official circles in Washington by Albert Wallstetter?
This is Ahmed Chalabi.
Ahmed Chalabi, right, who was going
to
be...
He was instrumental in making the case to go to war.
That's right, the Iraqi National Congress, that's right. Who was going to be, the George Washington of Iraq.
And Albert Wallstetter knew him in the 1990s, I think.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, that's right, that's right. I've been introduced to him by a historian, and I have documentation. They went to several conferences and stuff like that, and he introduced them to Wolfowitz.
Well, this is just further evidence, if we need it anymore, that Ahmed Chalabi knew how to make his way through the right circles in Washington.
Well, I have a chapter on him, and my editor was saying, no, don't include Ahmed Chalabi. That's history. I said, no, he's so important. He's like the cat with nine lives, is what they call him in Arabic in Iraq, and I fully expect him to be around in some fashion in the next Iraqi government. And he really knew how to pull our strings. He was masterful at it. And, he got what he wanted, which is the U.S. to invade Iraq and depose Saddam Hussein.
Right there? Yeah.
Hopefully, assuming we have a change of government and what would the influence of RAND Corporation be? Do you think they'll still, do they change the direction with the administration, or do they remain these ultra-conservative, war-mongering people?
I wouldn't put it that way. Like I said, nowadays they try to hedge their bets. I do believe that they will have the ear of the administration. Like the example that I gave of Barack Obama, and obviously McCain, would be much more prone to listen to the military advice that would come from people within the RAND organization, within the RAND Corporation. So no, they're here to stay. They're part of the permanent semi-official government of the United States.
How about all the way in the last row back there?
Thank you. Doesn't RAND to some degree if they do start to hedge their bets and, for example, make themselves more flexible to a new administration, assuming we wind up with a Democratic administration, doesn't that damage their credibility?
No, because they're telling their patron what the patron wants to hear.
But isn't their credibility based on, I mean, their label is being a conservative, hawkish, right-wing think tank. And if they start being proponents of less hawkish and more liberal perspectives, haven't they then set themselves up to be accused of being for sale to the highest bidder?
Well, I got to tell you that they're not really considered all that hawkish. I mean, in the think tank world, and especially in the right-wing think tank world, they're considered, you know, flaming liberals. And they would say, well, you know, we were asked to do this particular project, and these are the parameters, and this is what we're asked to do, so we're just responding to the wishes of the administration, after all. And, you know, this is under the guise of objectivity, which most of the time it's true, but, you know, like I said, you always have to question the foundation. And, you know, is there a moral compass to what you're doing, especially when you're dealing with questions of life and death and war and peace?
Louise, do we have some time for some more? Two more? Okay. How about this gentleman right there? The microphone is behind you.
How did, this is about the local connection, how did Rand end up in Santa Monica, and what relationship does Rand have to Greater Los Angeles?
I don't know what to say. It was nepotism or politics. Probably both. Here's how it goes. Hap Arnold, who was the guy, the general who cut the $10 million check for the scientist, well, his daughter was married. I believe it was his daughter. Perhaps it was his son. In any case, the daughter was married to the son of the owner of Douglas Aircraft. So therefore, he said, okay, let's put these guys at your airplane factory, and, you know, and let's take it from there. After a couple of years, Rand had grown so large and had done so many things that it was choking the life out of Douglas Aircraft, because the Air Force was no longer giving Douglas Aircraft contracts for fear of appearing, you know, in a conflict of interest. So therefore, Rand at that point became, you know, a nonprofit corporation. And by that time, 2 years had gone by. They liked the distance from Washington and the fact that, you know, they could do whatever they wanted, and they weren't under the Air Force's thumb, even, you know, because there had been some attempts to try to control them. But they had somebody named, they had a general who was Curtis LeMay. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of him. Oh, you have? Okay. Well, you know, he had their back, you know, so he was making sure that Rand was not going to fall, you know, under the thumb of some meddling general in the middle who wanted to do this or that with their particular projects, etc. So they liked being out here. They liked the weather. And they said, hey, let's stay in Santa Monica. And that's why they're still here. Can't blame them.
And the last... the last question, right there.
Well, this is a little depressing about this, you know, semi-permanent institution here, which is driving us toward war. And I wonder if you've thought about what can be done about it.
Well, that's how I end the book. I end the book by saying, you know, if you don't agree with what's happened, if you don't like Rand, you should look in the mirror, because all of us are responsible. We're the ones who have put these people into office. We're the ones who agree with what they've done. We're the ones who are, you know, the American people at large, who are, you know, accepting or tolerating the existence of these think tanks and of these administrations that hire these think tanks to conduct what might be morally dubious policies that advocate mass murder, that advocate what could be starvation for people. So we have to decide what is it that we want to do, and what are we going to do about it?
Alex, thank you very much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.